Welcome to the Ultimate Soulmate Summit, brought to you by The Soulmate Secret and the Calling in the One online course with your hosts, Arielle Ford and Claire Zammit. Today's Soulmate Seminar is with Dr. Helen Fisher on the topic, The Chemistry of Attraction, Understanding the Science of Your Love Personality Type to Attract Your Soulmate. Dr. Helen Fisher is a biological anthropologist, a research professor, and a member of the Center for Human Evolution Studies in the Department of Anthropology at Rutgers University. She is also the chief scientific advisor to the internet dating site, Chemistry.com, a division of Match.com. She has conducted extensive research and written 5 books on the evolution and future of human sex, love, marriage, gender differences in the brain, and how your personality type shapes who you are and who you love.
Welcome, Helen, to the Ultimate Soulmate Summit.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, we're so excited to have you.
Well, it's a wonderful topic. I mean, there's over 90 million singles in America today, and there's very little data on what their interests are, what they're looking for, what the stresses are, what the problems are, and so it's a topic that's of great interest to a great many people.
Helen, before we jump into the questions, we were really curious. What led you to focus your work on love and romance and human sexuality?
You know, I really wish I had a sexy answer to that, and I actually don't. I was just a regular kid like every other kid, and I think looking back on it, it may be because I am an identical twin. And as a small child, you know, people were always asking me, do you have the same friends? Do you get the same cavities in your teeth? Do you like the same foods? And so I was very aware, long before I knew that there was sort of a nature-nurture controversy, that a great deal of my behavior came out of my biology. I just simply knew that. And so I've been really focusing on sort of what all humankind has in common. And, of course, one of the things we really have in common is a tremendous capacity to fall in love and to form deep attachments, and also a restlessness in long relationships, a tendency towards adultery and divorce. And sure enough, that triumph of hope over experience, that drive to fall in love again. And so I think probably from understanding that there is biology to behavior, that turned my focus onto aspects of the brain that we all share.
Wonderful. We're really excited to dive deep with you today to really learn about these different aspects of our experience and understand them much more clearly so that we can become much more empowered to attract the right person and create the kind of relationship that we're longing for. But before we get started into the specifics of the science of love, I'm wondering if you can share with us, just from your research, what you understand love to be and any insight you have about why we crave it so intensely.
Okay. First of all, you know, love means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. So just pulling it back into the brain systems that are involved, I think we've evolved 3 distinctly different brain systems for mating and reproduction. One is the sex drive, craving for sexual gratification. Second one is romantic love, the elation, giddiness, euphoria, focus, possessiveness, craving for one particular individual. And the third brain system is attachment, that sense of calm and security you can feel with a long-term partner. And I think all 3 brain systems play a role in love, 2 different capacities at different times, in different ways for different people. But those are the 3 different brain systems, the sex drive, romantic love, and feelings of deep attachment. And in terms of romantic love, I've looked at the last 40 years of psychological literature, and there is a list of traits that generally people feel when they fall madly in love. First thing that happens is a person takes on what I call special meaning. As one man said to me, he said, you know, the world had a new center, and that center was Mary Ann. Then you focus on this person. You can list what you don't like about them, but you sweep that aside and just focus on what you do like about them. You know, their car is different from every other car in the parking lot. The street they live on is different. The books they read is different. Everything about them is special, and you focus on it. And then there's all kinds of physiological reactions. I mean, intense energy. You can walk all night and talk till dawn. Elation when things are going well. Mood swings into horrible depression when things are going poorly. A real possessiveness of the person. You can become jealous very easily. Bodily responses like butterflies in the stomach, a pounding heart, that's probably norepinephrine. The focus is probably linked with the dopamine system, the focused attention, and the bodily responses are probably caused by activity in the norepinephrine system. But the main characteristics of romantic love are intense motivation to win this individual. What people will do when they are in love is absolutely remarkable. And obsessive thinking about this individual. Somebody's camping in your head. You can't get them out. You wake up in the morning thinking about them. You go to bed at night thinking about them. You are obsessed with them. And that's probably linked with low activity in the serotonin system. So there's many other traits associated with romantic love. I write about them in my book, Why We Love. But the basic ones are those, this focused attention, the real obsessiveness, the wild emotion swings, and the craving to be with this person.
Mm. So what is it, then, that has us fall in love with one person rather than another?
Well, that is a complicated question. And in fact, of all, you know, I've looked at divorce in 58 societies, I've looked at adultery in 42, I've put a lot of people into a brain scanner to study the romantic the brain circuitry of romantic love, and nothing has been as complex as trying to figure out why him, why her, why are you attracted to one person rather than another. And of course, this is what Match.com, the internet dating site, came to me and asked me: why do you fall in love with one person rather than another? And at the time, I really didn't know, and so I had to pour myself into trying to answer this. I'm still trying to answer it, but here are some of the basic things that scientists really, at least I do know now. It's long been known that you tend to be attracted to somebody from the same socioeconomic and ethnic background. Most people do still, although that is changing to some degree. We tend to fall for somebody who's got the same religious and social values, a person who has the same degree of good looks and education and background. Your values are very important to you. So, but, you know, you can walk into a room and everybody is from your background and level of education and same degree of good looks and same religious and social values, and you don't fall in love with all of them. So why is it that one person just triggers that brain circuitry for romantic love and another just simply doesn't? And I think I think we have to then look at personality, individual personality, how we are all different. And there's two parts of personality. There's your character, which is everything you grew up to believe and do and say and think. And there's your temperament, which are all those traits that come out of your biology. For example, some children are simply more curious than others. Some are more stubborn than others. Some are more aggressive than others. Some are more agreeable than others. Some are more creative than others. We're all dealt a different deck of genetic cards, and with them we form what we're looking for in a partner. But anyway, so trying to figure out temperament, our biology, I came to think maybe we are chemically drawn to some people rather than others. You know, some people will say, well, we have chemistry or we don't have chemistry. And I thought to myself, what do they mean by this? So I began to look at the biology of behavior. And as it turns out, we've evolved, I think, four very broad styles of thinking and behaving. Now, we can act out of character, and we can change dramatically in how we, you know, how we express ourselves. But bottom line is, there's four very broad temperament styles of thinking and behaving. And as it turns out, people who I call the explorer, these people are expressive of the dopamine system in the brain, and they tend to be risk-taking, novelty-seeking, curious, creative, spontaneous, energetic. They're drawn to people like themselves. I've studied now, oh boy, at least 100,000 people on the dating site chemistry.com, the sister site of Match.com. And as it turns out, Explorers go for explorers, people who are novelty-seeking, curious, creative, want somebody who's going to get off the couch and go exploring with them, intellectually exploring or physically. People who are very expressive of the serotonin system, I call the builder. They're traditional, conventional, cautious, but not fearful, calm, social, often very popular, very good at networking, follow the rules, respect authority, often more religious than other types, very good managers, actually, orderly, conscientious. They also go for people like themselves. They want somebody who's going to be just as serious about this relationship and build home and family with them. The last two types are those expressive of the testosterone system and the estrogen system. I call them the director and the negotiator. I think Hillary and Bill Clinton are good examples of this. Hillary is very expressive of the testosterone system. These people are analytical, logical, direct, decisive, tough-minded, often very good at things like mechanics or engineering or math or computers. They're skeptical. They are very ambitious, politically minded, and sure enough, they are drawn to the high estrogen type, the type who's empathetic, good verbal skills, good people skills, imaginative, intuitive, idealistic, emotionally expressive. So people will ask me, and there's a lot of academic articles on whether we opposites attract or similarity attracts, but most of those articles are only looking at a couple different traits, whereas I'm looking at whole constellations of traits. And as it turns out, explorers are drawn to explorers, builders are drawn to builders, and negotiators and directors are drawn to each other. So it depends on who you are. And I do think that plays a real role in what we call mate choice, your basic body temperament.
Are we ever two of the same thing? Like, could you be half explorer, half negotiator? Or
absolutely. And I mean, because we're talking about brain systems, not, you know, not cubbyholes. So when you take my questionnaire on chemistry.com, you get a pie chart, and that pie chart will tell you to what degree you express all four of these broad basic systems. And there's some people who are very well-balanced. I mean, they actually express all four to almost the same extent, whereas there's other people like me who's, you know, off the charts on the explorer and the negotiator and have almost no builder or director in me. I mean, I'm terrible at math. I'm not very traditional, et cetera. But so people vary. There's no two people who are alike. You know, I have an identical twin sister and we're not totally alike. No two people are alike. But there are patterns to human behavior. And yes, to answer your question, no, absolutely. We're all a mix of all of these broad temperament dimensions, but we do have personalities and we express some more than others.
So in being able to know your particular type, does it help you to be clear about who you're looking for and who's going to be a good match for you?
Yes, I think so. You know, I've written five books, as you mentioned, and I think of all of them, this last book, Why Him, Why Her, has helped me the most. Mm-hmm. As, you know, because now, for example, I'm single, and I recently met a man who, he was a delightful guy. And very fine sense of humor, a gracious man, a handsome man even, my age group, everything. But you know what? He was a builder, and I'm an explorer. And although we have lovely times when we have dinner, but you know what? He's never going to go out to Coney Island on New Year's Day with me and dash into the Atlantic Ocean. I mean, you know, he's never going to, you know, just go to the airport and leap on a plane and land in Istanbul with me. He's going to plan ahead. He's going to be orderly. He's going to be more social than me. And in the long run, it may be difficult for both of us. So bottom line is, I definitely think that it is helpful to understand who you are, and that really helps you with who you're looking for. It's interesting, you know, after my book, Why Him, Why Her, I sent an initial draft to my editor, and he called to tell me what he thought of it, and there was this long pause, and then he said, you know, Helen, I finally understand my son. And I think that's what this perspective has given me, a very new, broader understanding, not only of my own parents, actually, but also my friends and certainly my various lovers over the course of my life. And even people like Obama. I think Obama is very much of the negotiator, high estrogen type. He's probably extremely well balanced, but it's interesting. In the Oval Office, he has a rug, and the rug is all around the rug are inspirational statements, inspirational sayings. And I thought to myself, you know, only the negotiator is going to put them do that kind of thing. And so I've begun to look at world leaders. I think, for example, George Washington was a really fine builder. Boy, I mean, that guy, he was traditional. He respected authority. He followed the rules. He was religious. He organized a government. He ran a tidy, not a tidy war, but a war that won. He was the right kind of temperament at the right time in American history. So I think that this understanding of personality can help one in many, many ways, but certainly in finding a sweetheart. And, of course, that is the most important thing that we do with our lives, I think.
God, that's so fascinating. I was wondering, I'd read somewhere that if you, let's say, on a first date, go bungee jumping with somebody, that the act of doing that and the hormones and adrenaline that are released could have you bond. And I was wondering what you have to say about other different triggers like smell or ovulation cycle or adrenaline rushes.
Mm-hmm. Well, everything plays a role in mate choice. That's why you can fall in love with the wrong person, because you're doing something with them that just triggers this brain system when, in fact, probably under different circumstances, it wouldn't do that. But there is, about the bungee jumping, I don't know that particular data, but there certainly is data that if you go do something really novel and exciting and new and different with somebody, that drives up dopamine in the brain. And I and my colleagues have found that it is the dopamine system that is associated with intense feelings of romantic love. So if you are just getting to know somebody and you want to trigger that brain circuitry for romantic love in you, in yourself, and or in your partner, I would go bungee jumping. Not bungee jumping. I mean, that can actually take the cornea, elucidate the cornea of your eye. But, I mean, at least go to a new kind of restaurant in a different part of town. I mean, go do some skating. Go do novel, new, interesting, exciting, and maybe even slightly dangerous things. I don't mean big dangerous, but even going swimming in a lake after dark, you know, it can be exciting, and that'll trigger the dopamine system and perhaps push you over that threshold into falling in love. However, we all carry in our brains what I call a love map, an unconscious list of what you're looking for in a partner. And if that person doesn't fit within that unconscious list, you're not going to fall in love with them even if you go bungee jumping every afternoon. I mean, for example, could Helen Fisher ever fall in love with Hitler? Never, under any circumstances. You know, or I'm trying to think of somebody, you know, contemporary. Bottom line is...
How about Rush Limbaugh?
There's a great one. There's a great one. No, bungee jumping won't do it for Rush. Nope, no way.
Well, but I think the fascinating thing is that so often when we are yearning for love and looking for love, and then we find someone, we meet someone where there are certain points of connection, we have those experiences, and then all of our chemistry gets triggered. It can really have us think that this is the right person when maybe they're not.
Right, exactly. And by the way, that concept, the right person, is often a little bit more subtle than one thinks. I've had people come up to me, women come up to me and say, oh, I really married the wrong man, you know, and then I divorced him. And I would say to her or one, something like that, I would say, well, how many did you have children with him? And she said, oh, yeah, I had 3 children, but, you know, the marriage was a total failure. And I feel like saying, that marriage is not a failure. I mean, from a Darwinian evolutionary perspective, you had 3 healthy, you know, stable members of society. You've had 3 children, and sent your DNA on into tomorrow. So from a Darwinian evolutionary perspective, this is not a failure. Okay, it didn't last for life. Many do not. But I don't think one should regard a lot of these relationships as a failure. They were good for the time being. If they had children, they were great for the time being. And now you've got an opportunity to go and find somebody who works next. You know, it's interesting. In hunting and gathering societies, you know, for millions of years, we lived in these little hunting and gathering societies. And from looking at modern hunting and gathering societies and their life ways, anthropologists believe that probably throughout most of our evolutionary past, women and men tended to have two or three spouses during the course of their lives, what I call serial monogamy, a series of pair bond relations. And so, you know, this high divorce rate and the high number of single people that we have in America, this really is not new. It's new for now because for the last 10,000 years we lived on the farm. And on the farm, partners really had to settle down till death do us part. You can't leave a marriage on a farm. You can't dig up half of the wheat and move it out of town. You can't chop the cow in half. You got to stay in that partnership and work that farm together. But for millions of years before that, women were economically powerful. They brought in 60% to 80% of the evening meal by doing their gathering of vegetables. And if they were caught in a really bad marriage, they walked out, and the men did too, because they could. And of course, now as we're moving off the farm, we're moving into an industrial and a post-industrial world where women are piling back in the job market, we finally once again have the opportunity to really make the kind of partnerships we want to make and leave the ones that don't work. And so I'm actually rather optimistic. I'm not suggesting that everybody go out and divorce. There's certainly some marriages that need relationships that could be perfectly fine if you just did a little work on them. But there's others that are probably never going to work. And we finally live at a time when you can walk out of bad marriages in order to make good ones. And as a matter of fact, some American demographers have said that we're now seeing more happy marriages because bad marriages can end.
I think for all the divorced people who are hearing you right now, they've all breathed a sigh of relief knowing that they've had these children and that it was actually didn't mean that the marriage failed just because they got divorced. So thank you for that. I was wondering, you've mentioned a lot of different norepinephrine and serotonin. Could you tell us what each of these things do and how they're different for men and women?
Sure. I don't know how they're different for men and women, but, you know, studying the brain is very new. I mean, we are really the first, and I and my colleagues are really the first in the world to put people into a brain scanner and study people who've just fallen in love, people who've just been rejected in love, and people who are in love long-term. So these chemical systems, we know very little about them, but we're beginning to figure it out. But anyway, the main chemicals, okay, let's talk about these three brain systems, the sex drive, romantic love, and deep feelings of attachment. The sex drive is linked with testosterone in both men and women. And young men have something like 10 times more testosterone, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything because it may have to do with the number of receptor sites, responses to the testosterone. Bottom line is there's not a whole lot of data, I think, that men have a much higher sex drive than women do over the life course. But although testosterone levels vary between men and women, the brain's response to that testosterone is not well known. And so I honestly actually think that young men probably have a higher sex drive than most young women. But by middle age, it's from what I've read, it appears as if women's sex drive becomes just as high, if not higher. The peak of men's sex drive, I think, is in their late teens and early 20s, and a peak of women's sex drive is in their late 20s and early 30s. So it's interesting. It's as if we've evolved so that at different times in life, one sex is, rushing after the other, but it's never exactly the same. So anyway, that's the sex drive. It's linked with testosterone in both men and women. Romantic love is now linked with the dopamine system in the brain. And I have not found that that women are more romantic than men are. Men fall in love faster than women do. They have more intimate conversations with their wives than women do with their husbands, because men are because women have their intimate conversations with their girlfriends. Men are 2.5 times more likely to kill themselves when a relationship is over. Men are more likely to remarry. Men have a stronger physiological response, a bad physiological response when there's a family argument. So, and in our brain scanning studies, we did not find that the female brain expresses more activity in the dopamine system when they're in love than men do. So I think it's a myth that that men are less romantic than women, and I think it's a myth that women are less sexual than men. In terms of the third brain system of attachment, it's linked with the oxytocin system and the vasopressin systems. And once again, I don't know of any data indicating women express much more oxytocin, and men do tend to express much more vasopressin. But both of these chemical systems, they're very closely linked, are linked with feelings of deep attachment. And I do not see data that women form deeper attachments than men do to one another.
Helen, I have a quick question. Is it true that if a man has more vasopressin, he's more likely to be monogamous?
Okay, the word's not more vasopressin. It's basically more, there's, the vasopressin system has different varieties. They're called alleles. Different. You can get a different variety of the vasopressin system. And there's one genetic type that is more likely to build unstable relationships. There's a recent study done in Sweden of 552 men and their female partners, most married, some living together. And they found that when men had two copies, you can have two copies of this gene, one copy of this gene, or no copies of this gene. Men with two copies of this gene in the vasopressin system tend to have the least stable partnerships. Men with one copy of the gene have more stable partnerships, and men with no copies of the gene have the most stable partnerships. So there's no question about it that there is some genetics to attachment. We haven't studied, I haven't studied any of it, but scientists have not studied the attachment system in women. So far, they've only done it in men. So we don't know. But
I can hear all the single women thinking, how do I spot that?
Yeah.
What's
important to remember, though, is that we're all dealt a different deck of genetic cards. Oh. And some people are more predisposed to alcoholism, and they stop drinking. Some people are more predisposed to nicotine addiction, and they stop smoking cigarettes. Some people are capable of keeping their weight down or keeping their work ethic up. In other words, we're not puppets on a string of DNA. And so even those men who have the genetic makeup to be inclined to make less stable relationships can make stable relationships. It's just that they've got to be more aware that they have a susceptibility and then overcome it.
Well, I still think there'd be a large market for the home testing kit on which level of vasopressin you have.
I agree with you. On the other hand, honestly, I think we express that in our, I think that we are pretty good at picking up the genetics of other people. For example, you can walk into a room and in 5 minutes you talk to somebody and know that they're a curious person, mm-hmm. or that they're an adventurous person, or that they're a homebody person. I think one can I think we actually express our DNA quite vividly. I think one of the problems is we're not listening to our intuition.
Think that's really, really true. And, I think that there are a lot of people, myself included, that was very much my experience, where I would so much of what you've talked about, where I would get triggered, I would feel attracted, I would think I was in love, or I wouldn't pay attention, I'd get involved, and then it would be, you know, very, very painful when the relationship didn't work.
Yeah.
We've been reading about one of the things that you say about how, for some people, getting over lost love can be as hard as coming off a cocaine addiction. Can you share more about that?
Yes. This is, you know, of everything that I've done, I just wrote an article on what I and my colleagues did is we put 15 people who had just been rejected in love into a brain scanner to find out what was going on in the brain. And I have long believed that romantic love was an addiction, a powerful addiction that made you do really crazy things, and that when you are rejected, the addiction becomes even stronger, probably a basic mammalian response to try to win back this individual. And what we found in the brain was we found activity in three brain regions associated with profound craving, and brain regions associated with addiction and craving. We also found activity in a brain region associated with intense feelings of romantic love, activity in a brain region associated with deep feelings of attachment, and activity in brain regions associated with physical pain and the distress that goes along with physical pain. That is not a good experience. You're in physical pain, emotional pain, madly in love, deeply attached, and intensely craving somebody. And of everything that I've ever done, this particular article that just came out in 2010, as far as I'm concerned, it's the most important article that I've ever written, and it's the most important article that I ever will write. And actually, I'm rather astonished it hasn't gotten more coverage. Although Discover Magazine has chosen it as one of their most important, 100 most important articles of the year, which was a thrill for me. But I still am not getting much press on it. And I just think, I mean, the number, I was once at a conference and a neuroscientist friend of mine said, you know, Helen, I bet more people, you know, die or maimed in one way or another from problems with romantic love than die of cancer. Now, I don't know if that's true, but around the world, the amount of people who stalk, who fall into clinical depressions, who kill themselves or kill other people over romantic love is absolutely dramatic. And when you take a look at world poetry, they've been killing themselves and others for as long as poets have been recording how they feel. And, you know, our poems, our songs, our novels, our sitcoms, our plays, our operas, all of our music, our artworks, it's dramatic how much of the arts have expressed not only romantic love, but really lost love. So, and I don't know, I've only met three people in my life who've never been dumped. But with those exceptions, and all three were extremely good looking, extremely rich, and I thought extremely shallow. But most people, we do not get out of love alive. I mean, we all struggle, and we've all been rejected, and it's a powerful human experience.
What would you advise somebody who's in the throes of that right now with the physical and emotional pain and the craving and deep attachment? What have you found to help ease the road to recovery?
I think there's many things. First of all, I think you do have to treat it as an addiction. Throw out the cards and letters. Don't write. Don't call. Don't show up at the gym. Don't ask about what he's doing now. Or tuck all the memorabilia in a box and put it in the attic. Whatever you do. I mean, if you're going to give up alcohol, you don't keep a bottle of bourbon sitting on your desk. Well, in the same way, you should not keep pictures around, things that remind you of this person. Get rid of them in one way or another. Go and get some exercise. Physical exercise drives up dopamine in the brain and can give you more energy and optimism. It also drives up the endorphins and can kill some of the physical pain, at least temporarily. Go out and do novel things, new things. Novelty drives up dopamine and can make you feel better. Go out with old friends and get hugs and kisses. That drives up the oxytocin system and can make you feel calmer. And whatever you do, do not lie down or hole up and watch TV and just ruminate about it. You've got somebody camping in your head. You've got to get them out. Keep moving.
Excellent advice. I wish I would have heard this about 10 years ago.
It's hard to do. You know, there's times you're lying there and you just start ruminating about this person and you can't get up.
Yeah.
You know, and you got to force yourself.
Well, just hearing so many of the things you shared, Helen, it's making me feel that dating is you're entering into very dangerous territory.
It's very dangerous, but it's also extremely exciting, and we do it. And don't look what the payoff is. I mean, when you're out dating, you will eventually find somebody, and maybe you will find, you know, life's greatest prize. Really, it's life's greatest prize. A good partner is.
Right, and I think that the thing that I'm really sensing in what you're sharing also is just that having this awareness can lead us to be much more cautious. Because I think there's a way in our generation with shows like Sex and the City, particularly for women in our community that we hear from, that there's a certain kind of encouragement to say go and have casual sex and to not really think about it, and then women feel really bad that they, you know, all this chemistry is firing, and that they have this intense experience of pain, and that they're not listening to themselves and their own sense of wanting to perhaps be more cautious and slow it down.
It's interesting. I'm of two minds about that. I've been studying hooking up with a scientist at SUNY Binghamton, Justin Garcia. He's looked at over 500 students. And I've had when you have casual sex is not casual. Unless you're so drunk that you can't remember it, it's not casual. Something happens. You're either turned on or you're turned off. Something happens in the brain. And when you go into a casual sexual relationship, you can trigger the brain circuitry for romantic love, because any kind of stimulation of the genitals can drive up dopamine in the brain and can actually push you over that threshold into falling in love with somebody. And then with orgasm, there's a real flood of oxytocin and vasopressin, and you can begin to feel a deep sense of attachment to that person. So some of these people, anyway, we asked the question of people who went into a hookup or a one-night stand, why did you do this? And 50% of women and 52% of men said they went into the one-night stand hoping to trigger a longer relationship, and 33% succeeded. So they don't know what they're doing, but what they're really doing from a brain chemistry perspective is going into a one-night stand hoping to trigger the brain circuitry for romantic love and attachment, and a certain number of them do it. So there's two ways to get the boy. Either you get him into bed right away and try and trigger these brain systems, or you are cautious and you get to know the person very well and trigger the brain circuitry in a different fashion. But, and I'm not suggesting, you know, I've tried both. Both can work. Everybody's got to run their love life their own way. It's not as crazy. But this, I think, is why people become so depressed after the one-night stand, because they basically did not succeed in creating a longer partnership. Mm-hmm. And that sends them into the depression.
Speaking of depression, what have you learned about people who take antidepressants and how it affects romance and sex?
That's a wonderful question. I wrote an academic paper for a book on this, and I'm just starting to study it now. But, you know, there's a lot of different kinds of antidepressants, but the kind that concern me most are the traditional ones, Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, the ones that only drive up serotonin in the brain. And any textbook will tell you that as you drive up serotonin, you are suppressing the dopamine system. And it's the dopamine system that is associated with feelings of intense romantic love. So as you drive up serotonin, you're blunting the emotions. Romantic love is all about, you know, ecstatic emotions. You're blunting the emotions and you're jeopardizing the dopamine system. And I think that you are also jeopardizing your ability to fall in love and stay in love. Now, it's really important what I want to say next, which is there's some people who really need these antidepressants to get out of bed in the morning, to sustain their relationships, to keep a job, to lead a normal life. I'm not talking about those people. But a psychiatrist recently up at Harvard said, estimated that about 73% of Americans who are taking these drugs do not really need them. Yes, they were depressed, the depression is gone, and they're staying on these drugs. And I think that they are jeopardizing a person's ability to fall in love and stay in love. And indeed, I get an email from somebody from around the world, really, almost every week, saying, here's a perfect example. It was a man, I think from Holland, I don't really know why, because you can't tell on email. But anyway, he basically fell madly in love with a woman and was living with her. It was 7 months into the relationship, and he was doing very poorly in school. So they put him on a serotonin booster. And sure enough, not only did he kill his sex drive, which that happens in most people who take these drugs, but he also fell out of love with the woman. And he moved out. And about 10 months later, he got off the drugs. And not only did his sex drive come back, but his intense love for this woman came back. And indeed, he went into a florist and bought all the roses that he could carry in his arms and went over to his house, her house. She opened the door and he said to her, "Would you take me back? I think it was the drugs." And she did. It's this kind of story. You know, got another story from a young woman in London, and her sister had been on these drugs from age 13 to 21, and that girl had never had a date. And I think I know why. So, you know, if you are listening and you are looking for love and you are on these antidepressants, try and find, I would say, I mean, I'm not a doctor, I'm an anthropologist, but I would be concerned about taking these drugs. And of course, if you fall in love with somebody while you're on the drugs, stay on the drugs. If you get off the drugs, you might not like them anymore. These drugs affect personality, and they affect, I think, mate choice.
So what advice, Ellen, would you offer singles in search of a long-term romantic partner?
I think it's the best time in human evolution to find somebody. Mm. Women are more healthy than they've ever been. They're living longer than they ever have. They're better educated than they've ever been. They've got more economic resources. They can walk out of bad relationships in order to make good ones. Same thing with men. We're seeing growing economic independence. We're seeing a growing understanding of what women want and what men want. We have this long middle age now, many, many years, and you're in middle age to find the right person. We've got things like hip replacements and Viagra and estrogen replacement. We're no longer expected to move in with our grandchildren when we get older. I think we're expected to go out at any age and find romance. And sure enough, we've got all these dating sites. You know, I work with Match.com and Chemistry.com, and I have tremendous admiration for them. But any dating site is going to offer you various people. It does take a little work. You got to spend a little time getting to know people and meet people. But it's cheap, it's safe, it's available. You can get online in your pajamas at night. We don't have any excuses anymore. People are out there. They are looking for you. And what you got to do is get up, get out, get to that computer, whatever, and find them.
You know, you mentioned hormone replacement, and I was wondering if you have any opinions on both men and women taking testosterone or bioidentical hormones and the effects of that.
There's some data that young women who take a birth control do change their patterns of mate choice. Instead of going for the for the high-rolling, high-testosterone man, they're going to be more likely to go for the homebody guy. They're called CADs and DADs, and women on birth control pills do tend to avoid the CAD and go for the DAD, and that's positive. Hormone replacement. I was part of the board of directors of the American Menopause Foundation, and estrogen does a lot of things to the brain, and I personally am in favor of hormone replacement, but that's to each person's got to choose it for themselves. But I don't think that really affects personality to the extent where a middle-aged woman is going to choose a very different kind of man if she's on hormone replacement than if she's not on hormone replacement. I don't know any studies of that, but it is my guess that by middle age, you know what you're looking for, you've had the kinds of experiences, you've learned to make more intelligent decisions, I certainly hope. I'm not always convinced of that. And that hormone replacement is not going to be a big factor in choosing the right or wrong person. Testosterone, it just ups the sex drive. But I do not think a person who's high on taking testosterone is going to be any more likely to go out with somebody that they wouldn't like otherwise. I mean, let's say you're a person who loves to go to the opera and to the theater and read history and walk through cities, and you start taking testosterone, I do not think you're going to start wanting to ride motorcycles and carry 6 guns and drink beer all night. I just don't think the brain's built that way. I just think it's going to trigger your sex drive. So I'm not too threatened by the taking of estrogen replacement or testosterone replacement. I'm much more concerned about SSRIs, serotonin boosting, antidepressants.
I have one crazy question for you. Has there been any research as to whether or not you can be in love with more than one person at a time?
You know, it's amazing how little research there is on love. I've done some research on it, actually, and one of the main characteristics of romantic love is that it's focused on one individual. I do think at the beginning, when you're starting to go out with, let's say, 3 different people, and you like all of them, you find them all amusing, you respect all of them, they're the kind of person that you would be interested in a long-term relationship with, and you sort of feel tingly and somewhat in love with one when you go out with him, and then you go out with another, and you feel the same tingly sort of in love, and then you go out with a third. But things happen, times change, people say things, people do something, and slowly or rapidly, the brain begins to focus on just one. And then you begin to get the full-blown experience. So the times that somebody said to me that they are madly in love with 2 people, I went away from the conversation thinking that they weren't in love with either. Mm-hmm. It is an experience that is focused on one individual. You see this in world poetry. There's a wonderful poet from India called Kabir, and he said the lane of love is narrow. There's room for only one. And all kinds of poets have said that, and I think most people would too. When you're madly in love with somebody, you can have sex with other people. You can feel deeply attached to other people. But that obsessive thinking is about only one person.
Have you, in your research, Helen, have you looked at what really goes for making the happiest and most lasting partnerships?
It's very interesting. There's a lot of studies on happiness in relationships. And they have found only one thing that they can attribute to happiness in a long-term relationship. It's amazing. I mean, for example, extroverts aren't necessarily more happy with other extroverts. Introverts aren't necessarily more happy with extroverts, etc. There's so many patterns that do not hold up. There's only one that I've found that does, and that is if you continue to think that this person, it's called positive illusions, And what the positive illusion is if you continue to think, no matter what this person has turned into, that this person is fun, funny, charming, sexy, smart, kind, no matter what they've turned into, if you continue to sustain your illusion that this person is the same person that you wanted to marry, then you remain in a happy marriage. And I've seen that. It's a very interesting. There's a lot of people now who are finding their high school sweetheart on the internet, and they are going back and meeting this person again and falling in love all over again. And I was actually doing a TV show once with a couple who are, I guess, in their middle 60s, both very overweight, and they showed a picture of the two of them as they were in high school. And, you know, so I asked them, well, is she still the same as she was in high school? And he says, exactly the same. She's exactly the same as she was in high school. And indeed, she wasn't exactly the same, but that's what he could see. And that's what he was in love with. And as long as he sustains that belief, he will remain happy.
It's sort of like wearing the rose-colored glasses for the rest of your life.
That's exactly right. And I think we work to sustain that illusion. We work very, if you're in a happy marriage, I think you work to sustain that. I think you work to continue to list what you like about them and try to overlook what you don't like about them.
Sort of the topic for my next book. I'm working on one called Wabi Sabi Love, Finding Perfect Love in Imperfect Relationships, and it's based on the ancient Japanese art form called Wabi Sabi, where you find beauty and perfection in imperfection.
That's a perfect example.
Yeah.
You are on to something. You are on to happiness. You are on to happiness and love. You are definitely.
Well, I think that this really speaks to, though, our expectations in relationship.
Well, sometimes we've got to lower our expectations. I don't know. There's some things, each one of us has some things we cannot do without. It's not negotiable. And there's other things that are flexible, we're flexible about. Mm-hmm. And I think that if we can continue to get the things we really want in a relationship, a lot of people are quite willing to overlook some of the little things that they had hoped for, that they will never get. But then they find things that they never expected to get in this person. What's really interesting, it's amazing how many young people think that these long marriages are sort of very stable, non-changing things. It's a constantly changing palette, a partnership. It's constantly changing. And we just did a study of people who report that they're still in love. These people were all in their 50s. They reported that they were still in love, not just attached, but in love with their partner after an average of 21 years of marriage. And we put 17 of them into the brain scanner. And sure enough, we found activity in the same brain region associated with intense romantic love as we found among those who had just fallen madly in love. The study was led by Bianca Acevedo, and Art Aaron and Lucy Brown and I were all on it. But you can remain in love with your partner long term, but you got to pick the right person.
I have a big smile on my face. What about you, Claire?
Yeah, me too.
Wow, this has just been so fascinating. I could talk to you all day.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. So, where can people go to find out more about your work? And
my website,
yeah.
HelenFisher.com.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And what are you working on that's exciting or new, or kind of what you're most thinking about and what you're doing next? Anything you can share about that?
I'm doing several things, but I'm really interested in personality, mm-hmm. understanding personality, not only in your personal life, but in your business life. And I'm also, with Match.com, really studying singles in America. There's very few studies of singles in America, which is absolutely astonishing to me. I've just finished going through the academic literature and found only a few basic studies of single people. And it's a huge population. And Match.com and Chemistry.com are now embarked on really studying single life in America. And I think we'll soon be able to give a good deal of data and understanding to this part of life. And we're all part of this because people who marry young tend to get divorced, and they're single for periods of time. People die, and somebody's a widow for a period of time. We're marrying later, so the young people are single for a longer period of time. It's a real phenomenon, being single, and there's right ways of doing it, and there's right ways of finding the right guy, and it's all possible. And I'm, as you know, an optimist.
Well, thank you so much, really. We're just so grateful that you carved an hour out of your extremely busy life to share this with us.
Well, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Ultimate Soulmate Summit, brought to you by The Soulmate Secret and the Calling in the One online course. For more information about how you can download the audios in this series or order the CD set and companion workbook, please visit soulmateaudios.com. Again, that's soulmateaudios.com. On behalf of Arielle Ford, Claire Zammit, and our event partners, we want to thank you again for participating in this series and send you much love and support on your journey to manifesting your soulmate.